Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
If you have been lucky enough to find yourself, wait, I can't tell you where. While the police were investigating, I can't tell you that either. Using a piece of equipment that some forces may or may not possess, and no, they won't tell you that, at a certain time, then congratulations. You may now exist as a random bunch of numbers in a collection of evidence that the police are storing, and they won't tell you where. Until they eventually figure out what to do with it. And they might not tell you what they decide to do with it, either. Good news, though. It's only a number, not a name, and some metadata. But there's no way they can identify you based on that, right? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. And are you being paranoid if they really are watching you? Yes, this is one of those episodes. Kate Allen is the Toronto Star's science and technology reporter. What's the latest way authorities in my city are watching me?
Well, the Toronto Police Service told us a few days ago that they have purchased a Stingray or an IMSI catcher, which is a type of cell phone surveillance technology that sweeps up data on all cell phones within its range. It's, you know, usually used on a criminal suspect, but it sweeps up everybody within its range.
Oh, good. How does it work?
So we don't really know because police have been extremely not forthcoming about how they work. And in fact, have in trials, in cases where these things were used, they've applied to not disclose anything about how they work or even the manufacturer or model of these devices. But roughly, they sort of force your cell phone or all cell phones within range of the device to identify themselves to the device. So they capture a bunch of different types of data. One of the types of data is an IMSI number, which is just like a 15-digit serial code. Okay. Associated with your SIM card. And then a couple other types of, like a serial number associated with the actual piece of equipment that you carry and things like that.
And cops, where are using these things?
That's a great question. We don't know the answer to that fully either.
Why not?
Well, the police have been pretty tight-lipped about it. They would say that they're trying to protect investigative techniques. And
right.
So, there's nothing compelling them to report to the public or to journalists that they're using them. And so it hasn't really come to light except for in a few court cases and when journalists have done some digging.
So what happens is that a case will get into court and the evidence will be presented and then you find out like, oh, this is how they gathered that.
Very rarely, yes.
And where have we found that they are being used?
The first we knew was that the RCMP owned some of these devices. And so a couple years ago, after some court cases where a little bit of info came to light, the RCMP sat down with some journalists and said, yes, we own 10 of these devices. We've been using them for, I think it was more than a decade at that point. So we know the RCMP uses them. Other forces have said that the RCMP has operated those devices on their behalf. So
okay.
we actually put in some Freedom of Information requests with the Toronto Police a few years ago, and it came back to us that the Toronto Police Service had used the devices on 5 separate occasions. And in the cases where they would tell us details, the RCMP had always operated it for them.
Okay. But we know they're being used in a few cities.
Yes, yes. So I can give you a couple other cities. So Calgary Police Service says that they own a Stingray. Winnipeg Police Service says they own a Stingray. And Vancouver Police have said that their law enforcement partners have operated one for them.
What kinds of data can this capture?
The police are pretty clear that the devices that they own do not capture private communications. So they're not capturing your text messages, your phone calls, your emails, anything like that.
Okay.
It also is not capturing your name or your telephone number. What it is capturing is an identifier associated with your cell phone. So the main one they're looking for is this IMSI number,
right?
Which is just, as I said, it's a number associated with your SIM card. It identifies you to the network as you.
Yep. What do they do with that? How does this help? Actually, this is a better question. How does this help in an investigation?
We don't know all of the uses of this thing and all of the times they've used it. So, as I said, only some cases have come to light. And in the one that I know best, which was a major drugs and guns case in Toronto in 2014, the police use it because what they're trying to do is figure out. So you know, drug dealers and gun runners and people like that often change their cell phones. So the police like them and use them because they can operate this thing at a location where a suspect is and gather all of the cell phone data within range of that location.
Public and private, like
everybody.
Regular.
Everybody within range of the device,
okay.
Including hopefully your suspect. And then they follow the suspect to another location, do it again, and then, you know, let's say another time,
right.
And then they're finding the one number that is common to all of those locations, which they will then assume is the suspect's IMSI number, and then they get a warrant to connect that number to that person's name. And the reason that they're doing this is because, I mean, at least in the cases I'm aware of, these are usually big cases that involve wiretapping. So they are trying to make sure they know all of the cell phones and landlines that their targets are using so that they are wiretapping all of the numbers of their suspects.
What happens to the rest of the data that they get while they're using this machine? I'm assuming some of these are used in crowded public places.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. The RCMP has said that when they capture all of these unique identifiers from all of these cell phones in a given location, there's like a person who's operating the device, and they only pass on the suspect's data to investigators.
How do they know which one is the suspect?
Well, by process of elimination, they're finding the one number that's common to all of the locations that they track the suspect to, and that's the number that they want. So now, with the hundreds and sometimes thousands of other numbers that they capture of, you know, innocent bystanders who they're not looking for, the RCMP have said that they keep that information sort of firewalled off from investigators. They secure it in a location that, you know, it's just away from the rest of the investigation.
Right, don't worry about it. Nothing bad will ever happen to it.
And they have said that they will destroy this data after any court case is finished, after any appeals periods have finished. This is an interim policy developed by the RCMP, so it's not a finalized policy. It's also not a law. It's a policy.
Right. It's something they've decided to do.
That's what they've decided.
How did you guys find out then that the Toronto police were using these devices?
So back in, I believe it was 2015, I was working on this topic with some of my colleagues, and we asked the Toronto Police Service, do you own and do you use a Stingray? And a spokesperson told us, we do not own and do not use one of these devices. Then we put in a series of Freedom of Information requests with the Toronto Police, asking essentially for, you know, any times they had used it. And a full 2 years later, we got information back that they had actually used it on 5 separate occasions.
Okay.
2 of them they wouldn't tell us about because they were either before the courts or still under investigation. And the other ones range from like a bank robbery, one was a missing persons, one was this big drugs and guns case. But, you know, so it therefore was not true that the Toronto Police had never used one of these devices. What was true is that they had always used the RCMP's devices in their investigation.
Okay.
So that was a year ago. So we reported that, you know, they had said they never used it. They actually had used it on 5 separate occasions. And just this past week when I was writing about the topic again, I thought, okay, well, we haven't really asked the Toronto Police in a little while if they own a device, so I might as well ask them again. And they told me actually they had recently acquired one of these devices for themselves. So that puts them in a very small list of Canadian cities that own one of these surveillance devices outright rather than borrowing the RCMP's technology when they want to use it. So I asked the Toronto Police, what do you do with the third-party data that you collect? In other words, these innocent bystanders that are swept up every time this thing is used. And they told me that they are still developing their policies, and their policies would be in place before they actually use the device.
What do privacy advocates think of this? Because on the one hand, the data is supposedly completely unidentifiable. On the other hand, you're tracking my cell phone in a public space, and I didn't do anything.
Yeah, so Toronto Police, at least, are pretty insistent that this is just a string of random numbers. It is not identifying information. They say it's not identifying. That, I would say, is actually factually inaccurate, because even though your name isn't associated with it, it's still a number that is attached to something that we carry around in our pockets mm-hmm. all the time. So, you know, your SIN number is just a number that doesn't have your name printed on it, but it's a number that, you know, corresponds with you, but you don't carry your SIN card around with you, and it's not pinging off cell phone towers constantly registering your location. And, you know, police can't operate a device that asks your SIN card, like, where you are. So even though it's metadata, it's not, you know, your name, your number, your address, it's still I mean, the whole reason that police want to, you know, capture these numbers is because they correspond to alleged criminals' cell phones. So it identifies those criminals to the police. So it is identifying information. And the reason privacy experts are troubled by these devices, I mean, a whole bunch of reasons. One is because the police have been so secretive about this technology.
Yes, that is what's worrying to me.
Yeah, so they've, you know, as I mentioned before, they've fought in court to keep even really basic details about, you know, the manufacturer and the model and, you know, basically any information on how these things work out of the public eye. You know, most police forces, the Toronto Police have said that they signed a non-disclosure agreement with the provider of the technology so that they can't even tell us how many devices they own, when they bought them, how much they purchased them for. So I think the level of secrecy around these devices is one of the things that troubles privacy experts. But the other thing is that it is just such a broadly invasive technology. So in one of the court cases that I've reported on, the raw data logs from this device were included as an exhibit. So it showed every single time this device was fired up, all the cell phones that it captured and all the data on those cell phones. And what I calculated based on that data was that every time they fired this thing up, they're looking for one suspect's cell phone, they would capture anywhere from a couple hundred to over 1,400 other people's cell phones at the same time. And so in a two-month period, when they're tracking 11 different suspects in a whole bunch of different locations, they captured 25,000 cell phones of innocent bystanders. Now, we couldn't tell from the data how many people's cell phones showed up twice. So a very conservative estimate would be that 20,000 Torontonians' cell phones were captured in a two-month period as police were looking for 11 suspects. The other thing that privacy experts are worried about is what happens to the data of these innocent bystanders after it's collected. Mm-hmm. And I think, so as I said before, while this IMSI number or any of the data connected to your cell phone, it doesn't say your name, doesn't say your address, it's still a proxy for you in a location at a certain time. And as this device is used more and more, and as this data accumulates in, I don't know, some computer somewhere in RCMP headquarters or wherever, it becomes it shows the location of a lot of different people at a lot of different times and, you know, with a lot of other people. So it says who else you're with. And again, without really knowing or being, you know, without any assurances on how this data is being treated, how it's being protected, how long it's being kept for, things like that. I think privacy experts are worried about not even abuse. I mean, abuses, yes, but just the fact that it's just like a very, it says a lot. It says a lot about a lot of people. I should say police are very insistent that they always get a warrant or that they need a warrant to use the device, and they need a warrant to connect your name and your actual telephone number to these, you know, this data that's collected with the device.
Are there any, you mentioned the RCMP has their own policy. The Toronto Police have a working policy or a work in progress policy?
Work in progress policy.
Are there any official guidelines existing or coming? Does the Privacy Commissioner have any ruling or say on this?
Yeah, the Privacy Commissioner did look at this technology. They were responding to a very specific request of someone who was concerned that their private communications were getting swept up by this technology. And the Privacy Commissioner sort of assured everyone that, no, this is not, you know, this device isn't capturing your private communications. But elsewhere, the Privacy Commissioner has written about how identifying metadata can be, and that, you know, in fact, it's often more identifying than your private communications. Like, you know, if the police want to see me texting my husband about buying more celery or whatever, that's not telling them a whole lot, but showing where I am at, you know, multiple times in a given day does say a lot. So the privacy commissioner has warned that metadata like this, while, you know, people don't feel particularly attached to their metadata, they probably didn't even know they had an IMSI number, they don't know what their IMSI number is, they probably don't care about it. But nonetheless, it is very identifying information, and the privacy commissioner has sort of warned not to sort of underestimate how identifying that information is. Funnily enough, wiretap technology, which is, I mean, more and less invasive. Wiretaps are more invasive for the person you're investigating, but less invasive for, you know, all the people around that person. Wiretap technology has very, very strict regulations on reporting. So every year, police agencies have to report how many times they got a warrant for a wiretap, or how many times they asked for a warrant for a wiretap, how many times they actually got a warrant for a wiretap, how many charges led from those wiretaps. And the idea behind this is that, you know, we want to know how often police are using this pretty invasive technology, and is it effective? How many charges are you actually getting from using, you know, this surveillance technology? You also have to tell the subject of a wiretap. If that person was never charged, they still have to be notified that they were wiretapped. But there's nothing like that for stingrays. We don't know how many police forces own them. We don't know how many are in operation in Canada. We don't know how often they're being used. We don't know what kinds of cases they're being used for. We don't know how many of these cases are major, you know, crimes investigations, and how many are sort of like ho-hum crimes investigations. Mm. We don't know. There's actually a case in Maryland where police tracked a guy who stole like $60 worth of chicken wings and subs with a stingray, like chased him all around town, sweeping up all these people's data, trying to get this chicken wing thief. So, I mean, that's Maryland. That's not us, but, you know.
But we don't know what we don't know.
We don't know. One of the things that I thought was, you know, the most interesting in the sort of raw data on these devices that I was looking at is I was looking at one suspect that they tailed. So they started out the day they used the stingray on him, and he was at a York Regional Police Station. I don't really know what he was doing there, but he was at a police station. So they used it there. Then they used it again when he was at a Milestones restaurant in mm-hmm. Richmond Hill. This guy's having a weird day so far. But anyway, so then he goes downtown. He goes to the Dufferin Mall.
Okay.
Jail, or maybe, I don't know, police station, Milestones, Dufferin Mall. They used it at the Dufferin Mall. In that one instance, they collected over 1,200 other cell phones because Dufferin Mall is a busy place.
Yeah.
Then they used it near Lansdowne and Lapin, which is, you know, an intersection in the northwest part of the city. So for that one guy, they captured 2,000-3,000 cell phones not belonging to him in that one day. That guy ended up being charged with, like, possession of the proceeds of crime, like, in a pretty low-level offense, and he ended mm-hmm. up getting 2 years of probation. Like, this is not a big bad guy. So, you know, I can't tell you whether that's an indicative, you know, whether that's a representative use of this technology.
Right, but all that data is still swept up and it's still kept somewhere. You deal with science and tech every day. Does this freak you out when you report on it?
No, I would say I was surprised. I was surprised by the breadth of how many bystander cell phones were collected with this device. I don't know why I thought this, but, you know, I knew obviously the reason these devices are controversial is because they sweep up this data. But in my head, I was thinking, oh, it was probably a few dozen, maybe a couple hundred. I did not expect anything in the order of 20, 25,000 in a single investigation. That kind of surprised me. I'll take a pass on the question of whether it actually freaks me out.
All right. Fair enough. You're an unbiased journalist. When you're looking for science and tech stories to report on, where it intersects with what we would consider, I guess, our right to privacy or the right to our data being private, has the bar been going up and up for what actually constitutes a breach of privacy? Because I feel like it has, and I could be totally wrong.
I don't know. I actually think that there's sort of a movement in the opposite direction.
Really?
Yeah, I just got back from maternity leave. I was off for a year. And in the year that I was off, I feel like the conversation around technology changed substantially. I think before I was off for the year, people sort of just assumed, oh yeah, you know, whatever, Facebook takes my data and that's just what I give up to use this awesome social network. And with, you know, the Cambridge Analytica scandal and so many other things that have happened over the past like year and a half, I feel like people are starting to realize that it's not sort of a neutral exchange. They're not just giving up data they don't care about to no consequence. Like, yeah. I think that people are starting to realize sort of what happens when your data is not private. And I do think that people are starting to understand that this has consequences. Whether that will then result in, I mean, I don't think it should come down to the individual person to, it shouldn't be, you know, incumbent on all of us individually to protect our own data. You know, yeah. I say this as someone whose mother-in-law, like, doesn't know, you know, can't figure out the difference between, like, text messaging and FaceTime. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So if not all of us.
I do know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. So, you know, we can't all figure out, like, which chat apps are, like, have the best encryption. And, like, that's not a reasonable expectation for you know, how to protect all of our data. So I wonder if there's sort of a movement in the other direction now, but I don't know. We'll see.
I feel like we're getting better about our online data at the same time as we're like, well, I mean, if my phone can recognize my face and it saves me having to press a few buttons, then that's good, right?
Yeah, I feel like I'm constantly swinging between being like, oh, God, I'll just let them take all this data,
yeah,
and like, you know, just assuming that nothing is private. And then, you know, the next week, trying to take all these measures to protect whatever I
can
protect.
Shut down my Facebook account right now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It just swings back and forth, and neither mode feels particularly effective. So I don't know.
It's a strange world.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kate Allen is the Toronto Star's science and technology reporter. That was The Big Story. For more from us, you can visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. When you visit, we are not tracking you, at least not very much. You can also find us at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. And of course, talk to us on social media at TheBigStoryFPN on Twitter and at FrequencyPods on your social network of choice, as long as that choice is between Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And of course, this podcast is wherever you get them. On any app you choose, you download it, we'll be there, and we'd like you to leave us a review and give us a rating. Claire Brassard is the lead producer of The Big Story. Ryan Clark is an associate producer. Stephanie Phillips is also an associate producer. And Annalisa Nielsen is our digital editor. And I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk on Monday.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.